tonight that has no blanks in it. It's also a good bit longer than the one last time, but you guys got to remember I've been working on it 2 weeks. This one we won't go over word for word, but it does have some information on it I think you might find useful, and particularly if you have younger ones that you're helping to work through this material. So you can follow along, and I will call your attention to this outline in a few places tonight. Look at the words that I have before us here. And let me explain just a bit. Remember, we started out with the song from which the rescued comes from, over in 2 Samuel 22. And then we've gone back to the front of this great book, and we've been looking at some of the things from which the Lord rescued David and therefore his people, the people of Israel. And we started at the kind of the farthest away from us as persons, from the mistakes of other people, the consequences of the mistakes of other people God rescued. And then from the actual actions and mistreatment of other people directed toward you from resentment and intrigue and stuff like that. And now we're moving inside our own hearts, now within our own character, with how the things that may affect our own hearts that would keep us from having a heart for God, for the Lord, if we're not careful. So these three things are, in my opinion, the three basic obstacles, religious obstacles to loyalty to God. Arrogance and idolatry and superstition. And I've defined them the way I mean that on the outline that you've just been handed. Arrogance is when a human being gets to thinking and act like he himself is God. Where the human being thinks that he himself and what he thinks is the measure of all reality, and that reality will just be what he thinks it is or wants it to be because he says so. It's very American. The second one is idolatry. And remember that in Scripture, the opposite of belief is not unbelief, it's idolatry. To practice idolatry is a human being making a God for himself, or making the real God to suit himself, trying to make him conform to us. So that's the second religious obstacle. The third one is superstition. And superstition I define as a man using a God as a thing to ensure good luck for himself, or as a thing to gain the outcome that he wants. God becomes sort of servant to the man in that way, or the servant to the whatever project the man is involved in at the time. A look heavenward may be in search of a home run, or something carried in the wallet may be in order to guarantee good luck. Some such thing as that. Now, look at those three things and try to remember how we've just defined them, and ask yourself, what do those three have in common? Arrogance, idolatry, superstition. Say it? All right. That what they have in common is man is at the center of things and not God. Okay, they have that in common. Now, why do you think the first one of these leads inevitably to the last one? As far as consciously speaking, it may bypass the middle one, at least as a conscious action. But why is it that arrogance leads inevitably to superstition? All right, you'll end up finding things that you don't control and trying to lean on something, therefore, to make things turn out like you want them to. What are some common expressions of that approach, arrogance to superstition? Pardon? All right, conspiracy would be one of them, maybe. Can you think of others? There are doing things at certain times. There are doing things in a certain order. There are doing things in the name of certain things. You can think of other examples possibly. So what I'm leading up to here is, do you think anybody, when you really stop and think about it, is anybody actually, quote, not religious, unquote? This is the most common claim, maybe the fastest growing claim in American life. Is anybody really not religious? No. No. There'll be something will either be most important to you, or you'll make something that you're devoted to, or you'll lean on some practice to try to guarantee good health and long life and success all in between. So what is the rescue from those three terms? What's the relief or the protection from falling victim to those three qualities? I think there's only one. At least I'm going to claim in our class tonight that there is. And I believe the older I get, the more I believe this. I believe it's holiness. I believe it's respect for holiness. In my class on Sunday morning, the other class, we defined holiness as that which belongs to God. And the attitude or action which is appropriate to that which belongs to God. And the only real protection, a rescue from arrogance, idolatry, and superstition is holiness. And this text tonight is about that, these two chapters. I mentioned Sunday night, last one or one before, that this part of 2 Samuel is in this lesson, this study tonight, is in my opinion the second most important one in this series. For a reason I'm hoping you'll see as we go along here. In these chapters, first off, David is in being rescued from the three things we've mentioned. David begins to reign as the king over Israel. This is number 3 on your paper if you want to follow along in that way. And notice specifically in verse 2, it tells us that God has made him to be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince. The American Standard Version says ruler. The possible translation is leader. Over Israel, over my people Israel. It's an interesting definition of kingship, very different from Saul's actions. Look over at chapter 8 and verse 15 and notice the summary of David's 40-year reign, which is there. What does it mean to be a shepherd and a leader in God's eyes? And remember, this is not talking about elders. This is talking about a political ruler, a king. It says here that in chapter 8, verse 15, I'm about to read to you from the wrong chapter. So David reigned over all Israel, and David administered justice and equity to all his people. That's what it meant to shepherd them, to administer justice and equity to them. And you think overall, now after next week we're going to encounter some rough waters, as you know, in David's life and reign. But overall, That was his practice and his leading these people, despite the problems he'll have in his personal life. Now, two big things happen in this part of 2 Samuel. Two things that affect not only the events, but even the language of the rest of the Bible. It starts here in 2 Samuel 6 and 7. If you don't study this, if your kids have no knowledge of this, there's going to be a huge swath of Scripture that they'll wonder, what in the world is it talking about? You too. If you're not familiar with what goes on here, you'll be missing out. And so think of it that way. The two big things, David makes Jerusalem the political capital of the nation of Israel, and he makes Jerusalem later on the religious capital of Israel. Those two big things change a lot of other things. In chapter 5 and verses 6 through 11, here is the religious capital, where David, having the opportunity to rule over the whole nation, chooses a place which is situated so that it can guarantee or provide for both the unity and the security. I brought a map here, if I can go to it. And I know you can't see the words, so don't worry about that. That's not what I want to show you. This depicts generally the way the tribes are located in David's reign. And if you notice, if I can aim this in the general direction here, if you notice, this southern part will be Judah and possibly Simeon over in this area here. And if you look right here, right about there, there is the city that was called, the very ancient city called Salem. In whose day? Who was the king of Salem? Melchizedek. So in Abraham's day, that was the name of it. In the day of David, it's called Jebus. So it becomes known. David chooses, if you look at that, if you can notice the gray area right in there, do you guys remember, it's right on the line between Judah and Benjamin. If you guys remember, when Joshua led the tribes into conquering the land, they attacked Jerusalem, or that city where the Jebusites lived, but they couldn't take it. They attacked part of the area, but they couldn't take the city. So the Jebusites stayed right there among them. So when David becomes king, he's been the ruler over this area down here around Hebron. And the tribes up here have all been ruled by Saul. If he makes his capital in this place, then there could possibly be a rivalry or problem with the people, the tribes from this place. But what if he takes a city that's located right there in no man's land? And what if he can conquer it? It's a town that is, I'll show it to you this way. You can't see that either, so let me explain what I mean. This is one steep hill here. The modern day Jerusalem is not as steep because the dirt and the trash over the years have filled up the valleys as much as 30 meters, however much that is. They're even steeper then. This area here was called the Jebusite city, which was the stronghold of Zion, or Jebus, as we said, Jebus, the town. Now, David takes this town. What you're looking at right there, as famous as it is about 11 acres of ground. It was a very steep ground, and if you look at it, it was surrounded on three sides by deep ravines. Here and here and here. It also had a valley that ran through part of it up here eventually. And then up here is the threshing floor of Araunah. the Jebusite. We don't meet it until the last chapter of this book. What happened at the threshing floor of Araunah? The Jebusite. The plague stopped, and David bought it to build an altar there, you remember? And what ends up happening there, up here on this hill, this rock right here? Before that, that was known as Moriah. And eventually, the temple gets built up here. So, if you think of it that way, on up the hill, right here, David eventually built his house. And then in this area down here, there was the Millo. You'll find it referred to this way, which most people that I can find think is terraced. The ground was steep, and so they built terraces and filled it in with dirt. And that made it more people able to have houses there, and also made it more difficult to attack. Let me just take us to this next one. Here is the city of Jerusalem. Notice out here there are springs from which tunnels ended up getting built to provide a water supply for inside the city. And what you see right here is the city of David, this area here, and then here, and here are the places where Solomon enlarges it. And then the gray here is where Hezekiah enlarges it later on. And then this area out here is where walls, some of which can still be seen, as I understand it, were built later on. So you get an idea of, and notice you have a steep place that has these valleys around it, like that, and walls. What can you say about that location? Be hard to attack, wouldn't it? Be hard to attack. And so it provides David with a place which unifies the nation, but also provides some security to it. Now, interestingly, the reason he's able to take it is partly because of the arrogance of the Jebusites who live there. David comes up against it, and they have this proverb. If you paraphrase it into English, it's basically, you go ahead and attack us, the blind and the lame could defeat you. You wouldn't even be able to take them. That would be the way it gets said in chapter 5 and verses 6 and 7 along in there. David takes it anyway. You guys, anybody here know how he did it? It says here the water shaft or the water courses. Over in 1 Chronicles it mentions that he told his men that whoever was able to strike the Jebusites first, he'd make them the commander of his army. Who ended up doing it? He went through the water tunnel. David finds the water course into the city where the tunnel goes from the spring into the city. His soldiers go in that way, and the arrogant people who thought even their blind people and lame people could defeat them, they're defeated. Joab is the one who does that. And this ends up, if you read the parallel passage in 1 Chronicles. And by the way, starting here in this book, you find parallel passages in 1 Chronicles. Generally speaking, the Chronicles explain the religious significance of the events that happen here in 2 Samuel. So it's generally speaking. The names of this place that I've got before you here, there are three of them in this text besides the Jebusite name. Jerusalem, verse 6, Zion, verse 7. This is the first time the name Zion is mentioned in Scripture, right here, 2 Samuel 6, or 5, in verse 7. Of course, it becomes very important. And then the city of David, verse 9. How many songs have one of those two, either Zion or some of them reference the city of God, meaning the same thing? In the New Testament, what does Zion come to stand for? Whenever you run across Zion in the New Testament outside the Gospels, what are we talking about? If your kids ask you, what does that mean, Zion's call? Or we're marching to Zion. On Zion's glorious summit stood. What do you tell them? Beautiful city of God, he said. Get more specific. In Hebrews 12 and verse 22, the New Jerusalem and Mount Zion stands for the church. Hebrews 12, verse 22. You have come to Mount Zion. In Revelation 21, in verses 1 and 2, the New Jerusalem either stands, I can't tell, for the glorified church coming in its final reward, or to the heavenly home of God's people who are with Him in a final situation. So this is an important moment in the rest of the Bible story. This is where God, in Deuteronomy 12 and verse 5, God had told them He'd put His name. There'd be a place where He'd put His name, and that's where they were to come to Him, and that turns out to be Jerusalem. And that means that what happens here forms the framework for talking about God as the great King, and the framework for the idea of God's people being with Him, coming before Him, seeing Him, all of that is bound up in this idea. David, if you look at chapter 5 and verse 10, here David, as he builds this city, he becomes greater and greater, for the Lord, the God of hosts, is with him. Verse 10, Hiram, the king of Tyre, recognizes David's ascent and begins to send the materials and do things to build a house for him. That means that Israel has become important enough that a king who's out here on the seacoast and who wants to do trading off there to the east has to make peace with Israel. Israel's now that important. He makes peace with David in that way. Verse 11, you can see that. And then I'd like you to observe with me what happens in verse 12. John, would you mind to read chapter 5, verse 12? Can you read that loudly for us? What does David attribute his success to? This is what holiness means in a person's real everyday life. John?
So David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people, Israel.
All right, why did David think God had exalted him? Was it because he himself was great? Was it because of arrogance? Was it because he thought he had had uncommonly good luck? Was it due to superstition? Was it because he thought he had made a God for himself that was able to do it for him? Why did David think he had been exalted to be king? It's in that verse. It's in that verse right there. For the sake of his people, meaning what? Was it for David? Was it because David was a great and good man? It was for the sake of, God did it for the sake of his people. And that will be something that David will come back to again and again. Now, one thing happens right here I need to call our attention to. This is the link between the next huge thing in Scripture. It's the Lord and David strike down the perpetual enemies of Israel, the Philistines. The big reason this gets brought up here is that one time the Philistines had captured something that was mighty important to the Israelites and carried it off to their town. They got hold of it at the Battle of Ebenezer. What was it? The Ark. That is this really important matter here right now. So what happens, if you notice, David in this passage, The Philistines come up to him, and if you, it's not on this map right here, but just off in this direction here, not very far from Israel, there was the valley that the Philistines, they had to come up an elevation from their land in the over by the sea coast up to the higher land here. They come up through this valley, and when they hear that David is the king, they decide to take care of him right quick. David asks the Lord, "Should I go out against them?" The Lord says, "Go out." So what happens here is David does what God tells him. Chapter 5 and verse 25 says, "And he and the Lord strike down the Philistines." That God breaks through against David's enemies. God lets them hear the marching, him marching in the sound of the ball, in the tops of the balsam trees. And then David attacks from behind, and they're completely defeated, completely struck down. An essential element of this story is verse 21. Look there. 5:21. John, other John over here, read that one loud, and let's see what happens here.
"And the Philistines left their idols there, and David and his men carried them away."
The Philistines left their small g gods there. What does that tell you about the place of the Philistines' gods in their lives? All right, how did they end up out here in the battlefield? They carried them with them like good luck charms. And when you see they're not going to do you any good, what do? Throw them down. And David and his men gather them up, and the Chronicles tell us that David and his men also did one other thing. They burned them completely. The Philistines suffered from a bad case of burnt gods here because they had gods that were like good luck, superstitious things for them. Now, think of the story behind this. Was this the first time any nation in the Bible ever carried something that was supposed to indicate the presence of their God out to the battlefield with them and got beat in the battlefield and left it? Who else had done that thing? Israel, in the days of Eli's bad sons, Hophni and Phinehas, went out and fought against the, what nation was it? The Philistines, this same nation, and they got beat, and they decided that God must have been unhappy with them. So instead of them trying to figure out why the Lord had forsaken them, they sent back and got the ark, and those two guys carried it all the way over there to battle. And the Philistines were at first scared. They got their gods with them, and then they fought and completely defeated the Israelites and carried the Ark of the Covenant away. A runner went back and told Eli what happened to him. This is 1 Samuel 4, by the way. Remember, Eli fell and broke his neck and died. So it was a trauma. He seems to have been more concerned about the Ark than he was his boys, in a way. The Philistines now had seen people carry the presence of the God out to battlefield and get defeated before because they had inflicted the defeat, but now here they are doing it. Same thing. So that's a weird part of the background of this. Now, you guys remember, by the way, what happened? This will be important in our story as well. The Philistines took that ark to at least three of their main cities, like it was a captured god. And they took it and put it first, and I think it was in either Ashdod or Ashkelon, in the house of Dagon, their god. Some people think he's the fish god. I'm not sure about that, but some pagan or idol god. And what happened? That's right, Constance. Oh, Dagon took a dive. before the altar. And at the second time, when he breaks his head and his hands off, they send him to another town. And over there, the people start breaking out with tumors. They sent him to a third town, and over there the people did the same thing. They finally consulted with some of their prophets or priests or whatever they were, and they said, we better send this thing back where we got it. And so they came up with an ingenious scheme to do this. Now listen to this. First, you got to do something to pacify that god. So they, I don't know what this means, but they got a like a basket of golden tumors and mice. I don't know about the mice. Some people think, well, the mice created a bubonic plague and that's where all this came from. I don't know, but and we get a new cart that nobody's ever used for anything. Remember, they're Philistines. They put the ark on that cart, and they hook up to the cart oxen who have never been yoked. They've never pulled anything. Have any of you ever seen livestock pull something for the first time? And to make it more of a test, we make sure they are cows who have calves. Have you ever tried to drive the cow away from her calf? And we'll be going, if those oxen then go away up the hills toward Israel with that cart, then we'll know there's something to their god. So that unlikely combination, the new cart, the green oxen pulling it, with calves that they don't want to leave, uphill, nobody driving it, what do they do? Where do they go? Head straight back to Judah. And they get to Beth Shemesh, and what happens when they get up there is the men of Beth Shemesh, who are supposed to be Israelites, take the ark and start looking in it like it's just a box. Bad move. There's 70 of them. Learned respect for holy things in the hard way. In that situation. Now that's in the back of this story. So that brings us to the next place. Now then, David makes Jerusalem the capital, the religious capital of the nation as well. So if you're following this, the nation is being consolidated into a whole life which is devoted to God. Are there problems, weaknesses? Yes, but is this a quite an achievement after the judges and after Saul? Absolutely it is. This is a whole lot different. Now, what this means to David is bringing up the Ark of God. The Ark for more than 20 years has just been left down there where the Philistines sent it back to. Just left. Left in the house of a guy who appointed one of his sons to be the caretaker of it. How it comes to David's mind to bring it up to Jerusalem, I think you could put two and two together, and he was thinking about things of God here. So what about the ark? That's an artist's rendering, by the way, and one thing that's probably not exactly right is that the Ark of the Covenant was the first piece of furnishing that God specified for the tabernacle, and the most important one. It was to be made of gopher wood or acacia wood, overlaid completely with gold. It was about 4.5 feet long by 2.5 feet wide and tall. It had to have four rings that were located somewhere on the side like that. It could have been lower on the side than that. The poles were also made out of the same material, meaning that they also were to be overlaid with gold, and the poles were never to be taken out of those four rings. And over the top of it there was to be a gold, all fashioned out of one piece now, all of what I'm about to describe, a gold, solid gold, not overlaid now, a solid gold top, the exact length of the ark, the same width of the ark, hammered out of one piece with two cherubs facing each other, heads down, and their wings spread out over the top of the ark. There's some disagreement over whether the cherubs are to be imagined as having human form, or a lot of times they're either represented as oxes with lions' faces or humans with human form with lions' faces. But what was the top of the ark called? What? The mercy seat. That's right. And there, what happened now at that mercy seat between the wings, the outspread wings of the cherubs? What happened there? Say it loud. God met the people there. God spoke to Moses from there. And atonement got made there on the Day of Atonement. Remember? With what? Blood. Yeah. So the mercy seat then indicated that a holy God was present with His people in mercy. And that wonderful combination comprises so much of biblical religion. Now, what was in the ark? Pardon? All right, let's do them in a different order here. What was the first thing in the ark? All right, the tables of the law, if I could say it this way, the covenant. So this gets known as the Ark of the Lord, the Ark of God, the Ark of the Covenant, and the Ark of the Testimony, because it represented, from God's part, His presence. For the people's part, their covenant obligations to Him. That's important here. Their covenant obligations to Him. Now, the other things you said that were in the ark got put there later on. They represented God's provision and God's authority. What represented His provision? All right, the pot of manna. And what the other thing that was in there, some of you said it over here, Aaron's rod that budded. What was the occasion when Aaron's rod budded? What did that mean? What led to it being there? Right. All right. Who was speaking for God? Yeah. The complaint started. Why should you guys be the only ones that God speak to who served before? And remember, God had them bring out their representatives, and whoever, they all had to take a rod or a staff, and whichever one budded, then that was the one that God had chosen to serve Him or to be before Him, and it was Aaron. And God had them put that in the ark as a reminder. Now, so this got put in what part of the tabernacle? The Holy of Holies. And this became the central thing to the sanctuary where God met His people. All right, so God met them there. The glory of God, which represented His presence, abode above this. And here in 2 Samuel 6, at verse 2, it says that they went to bring up from there the ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord of hosts, who sits enthroned on the cherubim. Enthroned. Meaning that in a way, this is God's throne was above this. So when it was brought to the city of David, what was being shown is what? Is David the real king here? All right, that's what David is indicating. David was, by his bringing the ark up, he is confessing, I've been appointed for a task, But God is the real king over his people. And that tells you something about the heart of David here. Now, how was this ark to be moved when it was moved? All right, only by the poles and only by the Levitical priests who were appointed to do so. There had to be a certain age group, a certain family of it. In Numbers chapter 4, it gives specific instructions about how you take down the veil and you put it over this and you cover it with blue cloth. Nobody looks in it. Nobody touches it. And whenever the camp head out, the ark gets carried out first, a distance of about 3 miles in front of them, and it leads the way, and wherever the glory of God stops it, then that's the place where they stop and camp. So there's a mystery to all of this. We've got a long ways to go here with this. So there's a mystery to it, but you get the general idea. Now, what happens is they go out to try to move it, and they put it on a new cart. Now, where did we get that idea? The last time they moved it, but who moved it back then? The covenant people of God? No, the Philistines did. We're going to move the ark like the Philistines did. All right, so but we mean well. We mean well. So a brand new car, sacrifices and all that, dancing and rejoicing before it. They go along. And you never can tell when the ox is going to stumble, and they did. And what happened? Uzzah reached out and took hold of the Ark of the Covenant, which the covenant said you don't touch. And you don't carry if you're not the priest, which Uzzah isn't. So what happens to Uzzah? God strikes him down. Why? It was holy. He wasn't showing the kind of regard for the holy that he needed to. Also, it's the Ark of the Covenant. And you're breaking the covenant. And that matters. And God has to some way educate his people about this, and even David about this. This makes David first angry, then afraid of God, and then not willing to move the ark any further. And it stays at the house of a guy named Obed-Edom for 3 months, and the whole time he just flourishes. He just prospers. Now, what 2 Samuel doesn't tell us is that during this time, David goes back and rethinks it. 1 Chronicles 15. And he realizes God was displeased with us because we didn't move it like he said to. David got it, 1 Chronicles 15 and verses 2 and 3. So he calls the Levites, has them to consecrate themselves to carry the ark by the poles, like the law said, and they went down to Obed-Edom's house, and with sacrifices every few steps and rejoicing all the way, and with Levites carrying it, they brought the ark rejoicing back to Jerusalem and put it in a tent that David had made for that purpose. And from this point on, God puts his name there with his people, amidst his people, and we hear people coming up to Jerusalem to appear before the Lord and to worship and to serve him. And we hear the promises of the law coming forth from Zion and God coming to Zion to redeem his people and provide everlasting joy. And a king coming to Zion riding on the colt of a donkey. And a stone being laid in Zion, a sure cornerstone. It becomes a stone of stumbling or either a rock of belief, one or the other. And then we start hearing about the heavenly Mount Zion and the heavenly Jerusalem and so forth, as we mentioned earlier. And it all starts here. All of Psalm 132 is about this occasion. The Song of David in 1 Chronicles 16, the Song of Thanks, is on this occasion. A whole lot of Israel's worship looked back on this moment when holiness got its true place in the life of the people, or forward to a time when holiness would be restored to its true place in the life of the people. So, what two big things happen in 2 Chronicles chapters 5 and 6? Number one, Jerusalem becomes the national capital. And number two, Jerusalem becomes the religious capital for the people of Israel. And both of those things form the language of the Old Testament and even the New from this point onward. What should we learn about our attitude and treatment of holy things? How would this apply to us now? All right, one should be humility and some reverence, Dean said. One, now think about this. David was able to rejoice like he did when the ark got brought up there because he saw what it meant in the failure the first time. Where there is a great fear, there can be great rejoicing over God's grace. I would wonder, is one reason why we kind of take God's grace for granted that we haven't ever stopped to think about what it extends us kindness for? I wonder about that. Well, you're overdue, but you know you missed last week, so what do you expect? I don't know. Cambry, do you mind to stand up where you are and lead us in the prayer? Does anyone else have anyone that we need to have in our prayer? Remember Debbie Rattery, if you would, please, Cambry, and I appreciate that. Anybody else? All right, let's pray.